thank you all for coming. We really appreciate it. Since nobody is here to see me, not even my lovely mother who's sitting in the back over there, I'm going to keep my remarks very, very short. I see a lot of new faces in here, a lot of new faces in the hallway coming to a Federalist Society event, and I know a lot of you are looking around and wondering where is the secret back, you know, smoke-filled room, and unfortunately it's still under construction in Gulkin Hall. However, we made the arrangements to have a windowless room for all of you. So hopefully you'll all enjoy it, you're all enjoying the food. It really is my pleasure to sort of start off the Penn Law Federalist Society's inaugural James Madison debate between Professor Richard Epstein of University of Chicago Law School and NYU Law School. My friends yell at me if I say it the other way around, Chicago. So, and our very own, who needs no introduction, although he will get one from Judge Sirica, Professor Ruger. And it is my great honor and pleasure to introduce Judge Anthony J. Sirica, former Chief Judge of the Third Circuit, who's now a judge on the Third Circuit, who is far too humble to allow me to give any of his great accomplishments in an introduction. So without any further delay, the Honorable Judge Sirica.
Thank you so much, and thank you for inviting me here this afternoon to participate in this wonderful debate. Students are going to be treated to a dialogue between two giants in the American legal community. Professor Epstein received his AB from Columbia and his BA from Oxford. He earned his LLB at Yale. He has teaching appointments at NYU Law School and the University of Chicago. He is a fellow of the Hoover Institution, and he has written several books and articles in many fields, including torts, constitutional law, health law. His newest book is entitled Design for Liberty. Richard, you have it there?
Oh, yes. The question is, will you have it on your bookshelf?
Okay.
It's my personal copy, so.
Oh, it is.
Terrific.
It's heavily soiled.
Professor Ruger received his BA from Williams College, his JD from Harvard. He clerked for Judge Michael Boudin on the First Circuit and then for Justice Stephen Breyer on the United States Supreme Court. He practiced law in Washington, D.C., began teaching here at the Penn Law School in 2004. He has written and published widely on constitutional law, particularly with respect to matters involving judicial authority. And he has a recent focus of scholarship on the Supreme Court and the field of health law. Professor Epstein will start the debate with 15 minutes of uninterrupted time, followed by Professor Ruger. Then each will have 7 minutes in rebuttal. And then we will open the matter up for questions from the floor. The approximately 2 years ago, President Obama signed into law the Patient Protection and Affordable Health Care Act. Within minutes after the president signed the act, a lawsuit was filed in Florida challenging the constitutionality of key provisions. Although nearly 30 challenges have been filed across the country, it is only the Florida case that the Supreme Court has agreed to review. The act is some 2,700 pages in length, consists of 9 major sections. Its most controversial provision, the requirement that nearly all Americans must obtain health insurance by 2014 or pay a financial penalty, is sometimes considered to be a tax law and sometimes is not. The decision on what it is affects the court's power to rule upon that provision and also could affect the ultimate decision on whether that mandate is constitutional. This controversy in the act focuses on the mandate, technically called the minimum coverage provision, that creates a legal duty for individuals to obtain health insurance by the year 2014. The two sides do not agree on what Congress intended when it enacted this core provision into the law. The administration argues that Congress chose the mandate as a mechanism to regulate the economic enterprise of providing health insurance, just as it often has chosen other means to regulate interstate commerce. The law's opponents argue that Congress has reached more deeply into individuals' personal lives than it ever has before, compelling people to buy an economic product whether they want it. A few facts. Congress concluded in passing this act that approximately $43 billion each year in health benefits are provided without being paid for by individuals who receive the treatment. Private insurance accounts currently for about 32% of this figure. Publicly subsidized programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and CHIP account for 44%. So approximately 24% of health care spending is not currently covered, and the mandate is supposed to, in part, bridge that gap. Professor Epstein?
Oh, thank you. I have not read the entire bill, and therefore I'm probably not going to talk about all portions of it, but the individual mandate is, I think, the subject of the day, and as best I can tell, it's probably best to concentrate on the Commerce Clause issues and to leave aside the chameleon question of whether or not we call this a tax or a penalty, if only because those issues seem to raise nothing fundamental about the structure of American government, but rather complicated questions about legislative histories, where the issues that you have to face with respect to the Commerce Clause, I think, are enduring questions. And the question, therefore, is how you start this debate from my side of the line. And there are two ways to do it, one which is commonly accepted, and the other is the one which I prefer to adopt and will argue for today. The common mode of attack with respect to this particular situation starts on the rather naive assumption that there is a seamless, uniform, all-wise web of Commerce Clause jurisprudence, which starts with the case of Gibbons and Ogden in 1824, moves through Wickard and Filburn, which was decided in 1942, is then synthesized by the master hand of Justice Rehnquist in 1995 in a case called Lopez, the United States against Lopez. And now the question is, how does that synthesis apply to this particular area? And it turns out, from the point of view of those who are critical of the bill, they say that we have now detected a discontinuity in that the mandate will require individuals to purchase something against their will, that the Congress may have the power to regulate commerce, but it does not have the power to force people into commerce, and so therefore, no matter what happened with respect to the previous decisions, we can make a respectable argument that this goes beyond the scope of the Commerce Clause and allows, therefore, a major piece of a health care legislation, all of the rest of which is indubitably within the framework of Wickard and Filburn, allows that particular provision to be struck down. Most of the people who are opposed to this are trying to launch a surgical strike and to say that we're not going to disrupt any other provisions of the Constitution and we're not going to disrupt any of the other many programs which have been acted under Wickard and Filburn and Lopez and the like. My own view about the situation is that if you treat Wickard and Filburn as a completely legitimate decision in perfect harmony with Gibbons and Ogden, it will be an extremely difficult task to win on this particular case. The only case that has gone this way in conspicuous fashion, or the most conspicuous one at least, is of course Lopez itself, in which Justice Rehnquist quite cleverly concluded that carrying a gun within 1,000 feet of a school does not influence either the volume of goods that are shipped in interstate commerce or the price of goods in interstate commerce, and so therefore is outside the parameters of the Wickard case. At this point, it seems to me that the battle of resemblances that you have to fight on our side of the line, that is, if you're opposed to the bill, is to say whether you think that the health care bill looks more like the massive programs for agricultural subsidies and the massive regulation of the labor industry in Jones against Laughlin, which launched the modern Commerce Clause of Europe, or whether or not this bill looks more like carrying a gun inside a school zone. And it seems to me that the battle of resemblances will surely be won by Ted, and he's going to remind us just how powerful those differences are going down the road. So the alternative strategy is to say, Wicked and Childers and Filburn is the kind of opinion which is entitled to no respect if, in fact, what the task is to figure out how it is that you're going to extend the Constitution. It may well be that the doctrine of stare decisis, the doctrine of constitutional error, however you wish to describe it, makes it impossible some 70 years after the decision was first handed down to reverse it. But given the fact of the dubious natures of its origin, we ought not to extend it to a case which everybody concedes has some clear conceptual difference between all the cases that have gone before. Even the conservative judges who have decided under these circumstances to uphold the statute, most notably our friend Justice Silberman in the Susan Seven Sky case, came to the conclusion that it was somewhat of a novel issue, but thought that the tide of history under Wicked and Filburn clearly meant that we had to have, quote-unquote, national solutions for national problems. If we go back, however, to the beginning, it turns out that we have a very different view of the Commerce Clause, and what I want to do is to remind people that the central proposition that undergirds all of the modern constitutional law, namely that Wicked and Filburn is simply a return to the position that we had in Gibbons and Ogden, is clearly the most erroneous proposition ever uttered in the history of American constitutional law. And that's meant to be an understatement, by the way. If you go back, Gibbons was a case in which the question was whether or not a monopoly for the use of steam power in New York waters given to Robert Fulton and his assignees was in effect sufficient to exclude the use of steam engine power in a boat that started in Elizabethtown, New Jersey, and came to New York City. And Justice Marshall had to make very clear that the definition of commerce was not what the states had contended at the time, namely the ability to regulate cross-border transits at the boundary line, but also allowed you to follow navigation into the interior of the states from which the journey started and the one in which it ended. He made it equally clear under these circumstances that inspections of goods before they entered into commerce or inspections of goods after they left commerce were in fact beyond the power of the federal government to regulate and were in fact within the exclusive domain of the state. And so what he did in effect was to have a three-part process before, during, and after, and he made it very clear that Congress was only able to handle the middle portion of this particular journey. This was not just simply a matter of constitutional construction by way of text, although it was surely that. It was also a matter of high politics. Let me talk about the two things. First, with respect to the constitutional text, the full text of the Commerce Clause is, Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations among the several states and with the Indian tribes. And it's quite clear that Justice Marshall said that the word commerce has to have exactly the same meaning with respect to the three heads of commerce afterwards. And he said it's quite incoherent to think that you're talking about manufacture, mining, or agriculture with foreign nations, or the same with Indian tribes. The word that he preferred to use, which came out of the standard dictionaries at the time, was intercourse with all of these particular places, which meant either shipping the goods in commerce or the modes of transportation. These are the first two heads of the synthesis that was given by Justice Rehnquist, Chief Justice Rehnquist in Lopez, and that was the extent to which he went. If you're trying to talk about this as a matter of politics, remember the year in that decision is 1828. If you took Wicked and Filburn, which resulted in the what is going on back there? In the regulation of agriculture, what you would discover is that it would meant that Congress, by legislation in 1828, could have abolished slavery in the southern states, a position that nobody ever thought to be possible at the time. And so what he did, in effect, was to have a situation which reflected states' rights as he understood them in national powers, and the major function of the Commerce Clause was to make sure that no state could place a barrier on transactions that took place between the several states, so that what you could do was to develop some kind of a common market across various sorts of state lines. This particular understanding was then carried forward. If you go back and you read cases like Kidd v. Pearson from 1888 and E.C. Knight against the United States in 1895, all of them stand for the proposition that you do not bring something into interstate commerce solely because you can show that an increase in the level of production in agriculture, mining, or manufacturing will produce more goods that go into interstate commerce. In other words, they stand for the exact contrary proposition that was put forward in Wicked and Filburn in order to extend the scope of the commerce power. Modern thinkers often want to make it appear as though there is some deep philosophical ambiguity in this, but if you look at all the actions that took place between E.C. Knight in 1895 and Wickett and Filbert in 1942, they're perfectly consistent with this understanding. My favorite example on this particular point is you look at the decisions creating the Pure Food and Drug Act in 1906, and what they make very clear is that Congress can regulate the movement of drugs across interstate lines. That's just fine. It can regulate their manufacture when they're in the territories, but this huge reformist, i.e. Teddy Roosevelt, understood that Congress could not regulate the manufacture of drugs in the states in 1906. And in fact, one of the great reasons for the American advance in technology during those particular periods was that we did not have an FDA. The moment the FDA gets the power over manufacture, things start to slow down. When does that happen? It happens in 1938. That year is not just an accident. It's 1 year after the 1937 revolution that took place, where now, in effect, manufacture within the states is, in fact, the kinds of things that we are talking about. So the history on this is pretty uniform. Before you get yourself up to Wickett and Filbert, there is nobody, apart from scholars of a later day who want to make history seem more confused than it was, who find in the term commerce the great sort of philosophical puzzles that led to the decision in Wickett and Filbert. Now, why did we get Wickett and Filbert? The argument that is customarily given as to why we need this is that we have to have national responses to national problems, and this, of course, was a constant theme during the New Deal. It is also one of the most disastrous arguments that you could make, even if it's made by people of impeccable conservative credentials like Justice Silberman. If you go back and look at the two cases that were dealing with the expansion of the Commerce Clause, one of them, Jones and Laughlin, was designed to secure the operation of monopoly institutions called collective bargaining and labor. And Wickett and Filbert was essentially a situation where the Department of Agriculture realized that the only way it could organize a nationwide agricultural cartel was to regulate the production of farm goods like grains that were fed to people who vertically integrated their business, i.e. who fed their own corn to their own cattle. So that the expansion with respect to the situation of commerce power was designed to sustain the worst kinds of national institutions, cartels. In effect, this is a situation where the national power is the national problem, not a solution to it. And if you would have been able to keep to the earlier versions on that, Congress would have still had some influence about the movement of goods across state lines, but would never have been able to organize through the Agricultural Adjustment Act or the National Labor Relations Act the kind of cartel-like arrangements which essentially dominated the way in which the world has run since that time, with enormous social losses. So it seems to me that to argue that you need to have a national solution, you have to be able to find something that the national government can do that ought to be done, rather than to postulate it's up for Congress to decide what's good and what's bad. The great difference between the pre-New Deal cases, which I support, and the post-New Deal cases is simply this. The pre-New Deal guys understood that small markets and competitive markets were much more important than state monopolies. They were quite sure that it was important to have a federal government that could prevent blockades on interstate transportation by the various states, which was an important issue with railroads in that time. But it was equally important to make sure that they could not become a problem themselves by cartelizing the way in which ordinary business runs. And under the New Deal, the situation is now quite different. The ideology of the time says whether or not we create market type of institutions or cartel type of institutions are all political judgments which we in Congress are able to make, and that's exactly what they did. All of the people in the New Deal were violently against monopoly. That sounds great until you understand that they were strongly in favor of was the creation of cartel-like operations. Now, this is the reality. The subsequent decisions after Wickett come back and said that Wickett just reinforced and restated the position in Gibbons and Ogden. And I hope from what I've said that you realize that that's a monstrous falsehood. The question then comes, what ought we to do with this information once we have it? And there are two things to understand. One of them is once you put a set of social institutions in place and keep them as long as you have, it is extremely difficult to undo those institutions given the reliance interest that everybody has on the state of affairs that has been created. We have huge national institutions today, most of which, in my judgment, are unwise, but to try to undo them after they've already put into place will create the kind of dislocations which essentially offend what we call the reliance interest. So there is in constitutional law, I think quite rightly, a very long debate is when you have entrenched errors, what do you do about it? And in some particular cases, like with Plessy and Ferguson, what you decide to do about it is to overturn it, and you do so after several years and a series of painful decisions culminating in 1954 with Brown v. Board of Education. But in other cases where it turns out the decisions are really beneficial to the nation, as for example in the development of the Dormant Commerce Clause, which is largely fictive, the idea that you would want to prevent the courts from enforcing open national markets by undoing a set of precedents that also began with Gibbs and Ogden seems to me to be a terrible mistake. But when you start looking at the healthcare situation, it seems to me quite impossible today for somebody to come forward and say, look, we know that Medicare is all a giant mistake. We know that Medicaid is exclusively a state function, all of which I think are in principle true. But since we already have these things into place and have to respect the reliance interest, we leave them. But with respect to healthcare and the mandate, which everybody conceives to be a conceptual distinction, what happened before, there's no reason to take a set of precedents which have served us so ill as a nation and announce them to be sacred text with all the blessing of everybody, not only from Justice Rehnquist, but from Justice Marshall, and to use that as the basis for our subsequent deliberation. So that then means you necessarily have to think of what do you think about the desirability of the particular legislation in question. And here, I don't know how much time there is, but you should tell me.
5 minutes.
5 minutes left. I've only talked for 10. But I think that what you ought to do under these circumstances is to ponder that the mandate is only one part of a very complicated statute, the other portions of which are, in my mind, much more important to its overall operations and which, in fact, create very serious kinds of dislocation. If anybody has actually looked at the way in which somebody wants to try to organize these exchanges under the federal government and the sort of backhanded system of price regulations that they're going to have to use on it, I think you will quickly realize that what this bill is a Tepempian village. It will promise universal health care to everybody. But given the difficulties of its administration, what will happen is it will manage to supply these particular benefits to very few people. What happens when you overcommit a national government to a program which it cannot honor by the creation of an endless set of positive rights is that health care will be rationed by putting people on queues. Nobody will be prepared to deny the entitlement outright, but nobody will be able to fund it. Going forward, that's going to be an extremely difficult issue to face in this particular country because what happens is the appropriation for the bills, which will only take effect as of 2014, are not yet done, and we are likely to have a huge kind of impasse and blockade as resentful Republicans who believe that a fast one was pulled upon them in 2010 will now take due revenge on the Democrats who are coming up for challenge in the appropriations process where the Republicans hold the House. Now, in face of this kind of situation, what is going to happen if you decide to strike down the individual mandate? Well, I think the answer is there's probably going to be a serious sense in which the entire legislation will probably topple, at least with respect to Title I, because there will be no sufficient ways to handle the funding. One of the real intrinsic difficulties that one sees in the way in which the mandate has been organized is its defenders speak simultaneously of two ills, which are the antithesis of each other. On the one hand, what they do is they announce that those people who don't take this kind of protection are, in fact, going to basically become freeloaders on the system, and they will get something for nothing. And then on the other hand, they say, we have to force you people into these programs because otherwise we cannot subsidize people on the other side who are going to pay less than they ought to because of the way in which we have universal averaging under the bill. If you are caring seriously about the first issue, what you should do is to tell people you have to be able to take out an amount of insurance which covers you and only you and doesn't contribute anything to the cross-subsidy. And if you're worried about the cross-subsidy, then you're going to probably need a lot more money coming in through the mandate than is currently provided. So you have this kind of ambiguity. And what happens is if you keep this particular bill in place without the particular mandate, the severability issues, I think, will become very serious. And they will also become serious with respect to all the issues on Medicaid where you have the crosses. So it's a very difficult question for what to do. But I think, and I'll just end on this note, there's something deeply ironic about trying to put this thing in the bill and to fight it under the Commerce Clause when so many people are worried about the implications with respect to individual autonomy. But this is only the last part of our topsy-turvy debate, which we have. We hear, as Judge Sirica announced, all the concerns with individual liberty. They never apply against the state. All the individual liberty claims have been rejected. And so we're left with this very awkward situation where our own twisted history of federalism has put us in this difficult and untenable position. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Judge. Thank you, Professor Epstein, and the Federalist Society for organizing this. We've done this before. This is always fun. I'll start. I want to try to make 9 points in 15 minutes, and I realize, thinking about recent political debates, it's always perilous to specify the number of points you're going to make and then try to follow through, but I'll try to fit nine in. I should say also, Richard, that as always, your comments are provocative, original in the sense that my 9 points respond in a sense to the prevailing oppositional arguments, which are somewhat different. And I'm kind of rewriting a few of the points, and then we'll continue in my response to try to respond specifically to some of the historical points you make. And we share a lot of agreement, I think, about the kind of doctrinal mismatch between our current Commerce Clause doctrine, as articulated by Justice Rehnquist in Lopez and Morrison, and the particular liberty concerns here. I, too, think the doctrine is a bad fit. That leads me to suggest that the court shouldn't use this mismatched doctrine to strike it down, but I'll say more about that. Okay, so 9 points. 3 quick atmospheric points, 3 doctrinal points, and then 3 more kind of structural, historical points about what's at stake here in the liberty. First point refers back to our debate 2 years ago at Harvard in the Federalist Society. There we debated the ACA. It was an interesting, productive debate. Nary a peep came up about constitutional challenges. We debated the policy, the exchanges, a very rich debate. And this was just, yeah, about give or take a month. It was about 2 years ago. This suggests to me, and this is my first point, that what we've got going on here and what's taking place at the Supreme Court this spring is an exercise in evolving, dare I say, living constitutionalism about what is, about our constitutional discourse and what may or may not be constitutionally impossible. To sharpen that point, 2 years ago, or 4 years ago, or 8 years ago, everyone, almost everyone in the academy, thought that this, that the individual mandate's constitutionality was almost a no-brainer under current doctrine. And here, the discussion of Lopez is helpful. My constitutional law teacher, Charles Freed, at Harvard 2 years ago, was quoted as saying he would eat his hat if the court struck down the individual mandate, and I suggest he's at least looking into condiments for hats at this point. Indeed, to show how our conception of Commerce Clause restrictions have evolved, when Professor Freed taught me constitutional law in, I believe, the spring of 1994, it was pre-Lopez, we didn't study the Commerce Clause. Maybe some of you would have wished to have taken constitutional law in that regime. We did study the dormant Commerce Clause, to be technical. But Professor Freed said for 60 years at that point, this has not been a serious limitation. So what we're debating here really is something a bit novel, and it's a testament to attorneys and the public at large, kind of an exercise in popular constitutionalism, shifting the constitutional discourse. Second point, quickly, and again, hearteningly, I think, this is an argument about principle. Most people arguing against the mandate already have insurance and indeed face their own mandate to purchase through large group plans wherever you go work. So you think you're opposed to individual mandates to buy health insurance. Any of you who go to work at a big firm or a big university are subject to a kind of, based on private ordering, the convention that part of your compensation is going to be health insurance, whether you want it or not. You're arguing on behalf of people who, you know, are solo practitioners, kind of hypothetical individualists who aren't already subject to the large group market. So too, those of us who support this act and the mandate as an essential part of it, most of us, this is a feature, a political, almost market failure in the U.S. system that has confounded national health reform, is about 80 to 85% of Americans have reasonably decent insurance, most of us through the large group employer market, some through Medicare, some through Medicaid. But we've had difficulty now for decades in doing what other countries have done in extending access to that last 15%, predominantly because so many people already have it. So this is kind of an argument about principle on both sides. Third atmospheric point, less optimistically, I think, is there is a cost to debating these doctrinal niceties as a society in light of a health system that here I think we both agree is fundamentally broken and needs reform, both the private provision of health care and health insurance and the public systems. Have struggled unsuccessfully to control costs and improve quality. The ACA is a step in that direction, a highly unspecified step, perhaps an imperfect step, but a step. But in a sense, this debate over the individual mandate only obscures and delays the debate that we are all going to have over the next decade or two, whatever the Supreme Court does, which is how to reorganize our fragmented healthcare systems and better control costs, et cetera. And the implications of not dealing with that impinge on individual liberty, autonomy, impose costs and taxes on us, and a drag on our wages in the private sector, far more than any penalty that this mandate might impose. So to the extent this slows us down, and particularly an adverse Supreme Court ruling would slow us down from really dealing with the systemic issues in the American healthcare system, there really are costs to this, and adverse costs. Okay, so those are the three atmospheric points. A few points about the doctrine, which I ought to revise in light of my colleagues' statements that, about Lopez, etc. The point I was going to make, first point, is that there is a well-established Commerce Clause doctrine. Chief Justice Rehnquist stated it in Lopez. And under that doctrine, I think this is a pretty straightforward case, bracketing something you didn't mention at all, which is this activity. Inactivity distinction, and I may say a couple words about that because that's such an important point for the lower court judges who have ruled against the mandate and in the briefs. But the Commerce Clause, at least since Wickard, I think the path has been pretty clear and as codified by Lopez that they're on this third prong, that there's a few basic principles that both the Supreme Court justices and lower court judges have fairly consistently applied, namely that Congress can regulate things that happen within a state, so long as it is economic behavior, which, if aggregated, substantially affects interstate commerce. So there's a few, you could put it in your outlines in common law class and a few different things. You know, we need economic behavior, we need, when aggregated, substantial economic effect, but then there's the Wickard, and I would add the Raich principle, this is the medical marijuana case, permits us aggregating those effects. And if you apply that to this case, this is now the second doctrinal point. Those principles applied to this case, most of them apply easily. Okay, we're talking about a congressional regulation of a component of our economy, provision of health care, which now accounts for 17% of GDP and growing. The health insurance markets are a substantial share of that. The decision of whether or not to purchase insurance or whether or not to manage risk is quintessentially economic decision, entire wings over at places like Wharton devoted to the economic decision of how to handle and hedge and insure against risk, quintessentially economic choice. In a way, at least for the Supreme Court, domestic violence was not in Morrison. Obviously, people debate that, but here we have a quintessentially economic case. And all of that is fairly easy. We also have evidence that this is a case where national government intervention may be warranted as a policy matter. There are issues based on races to the bottom and different states where we're asking states to do this bit by bit as Massachusetts did, and Massachusetts has a very unique healthcare structure. Asking all 49 other states to do this, many experts believe is not a feasible solution. Moreover, bumpy regulation of insurance in different states exerts a drag on the national job market in different ways. When people, there's a phenomenon health economists know well called job lock, where somebody might have a pre-existing condition, but they're an efficient worker, they want to take a job in another state. That state doesn't guarantee that they won't be excluded or priced out of the market based on that condition. That may well hinder labor market mobility and other free market effects. So there's reasons to do this as a national government. Now, the third point I was going to make, I won't spend as much time on it, is this activity in an inactivity distinction. Suffice it to say that, and here I'm channeling Judge Jeffrey Sutton of the Sixth Circuit, whose concurrence I think does the best job of of conceptually blowing the activity and inactivity distinction out of the market. After all, what we're dealing here is with the autonomous choice that people make, infused with all the notions of agency that we all think about autonomous choice having, about whether or not to buy insurance. Or to put differently, the autonomous choice about how to handle personal medical risk. One choice, an active, agency-laden choice, is to go out and get insurance. Another conscience, fully kind of agency-driven choice is to say, I'm exercising my autonomy not to buy insurance. That's to say that there's somehow some regulatory distinction that would hinge. And by the way, those decisions, of course, then when aggregated, have a huge effect on the national economy. To say that there's some talismanic significance to physical action in buying or not buying insurance would be a strange constitutional rule indeed. And I could, to play charades for 30 seconds here, what I'm doing here is sprinkling some marijuana seeds in my garden or in a pot that I'm going to put in my closet. And, you know, this is the action. This here, this waving of the hand, is enough to subject me to federal jurisdiction under Raich, which upheld federal law criminalizing somebody growing marijuana in a closet or in their backyard, totally for home use. So this is enough, this action. Now, we don't tend to think of constitutionally, we don't tend to favor constitutional regimes where a hand wave is the meets and bounds of kind of national jurisdiction. This seems like something a medieval king would do, you know, off with their head. Well, the hand wave carries jurisprudential significance. It ought not. Some trivial action in service, by the way, of a regulatory regime, i.e. medicinal marijuana, which is whose substantial economic effects pale in comparison with the choices about whether or not to buy health insurance. We shouldn't give kind of talismanic effect to some literally physical action, because we are talking about choices in both instances. Okay, now I guess to say a little bit more about the history, so I've been making these doctrinal points, to say a bit more about the history here, I would say, and excuse me, Judge, do I have about 5 minutes left? Or?
Six or seven.
Six, I'll take that, okay. So I'll use those couple extra just to refer back to the history. I agree with you completely about Gibbons. There's no way to read Gibbons, given that precedent from the 1820s, as justifying the government action in this case. What's my response? I have a few 20th century responses, but I do have a few 18th or 19th century responses. The 20th century responses are, you know, we live in a regime of evolving constitutionalism. There are lots of constitutional doctrines that look different in 2012 than they did in 1820, and that's a good thing. We live in a stare decisis-based system, so that, and we have built up the structure of government in reliance on cases like Wickard and, you know, then restated that law in Lopez. And again, I would stress the Raich case a bit, which really dealt with a trivial matter, somebody growing stuff at home, and restated the Lopez Commerce Clause principles, and added discussion of a clause we haven't talked as much about, which I think is important here too, namely the Necessary and Proper Clause, the notion being that when Congress regulates, has a regulatory scheme that is undoubtedly interstate substantial economic effects, health insurance regulation fits that bill easily, it has a choice in the means, and it has a fair bit of latitude in the choice of means to effectuate that choice, even where those choices push the constitutional margins. Okay, Raich said that. The 19th century case that said that, it's not Gibbons, it's McCulloch versus Maryland, which is important in a few ways, I think, in the sense that Justice Marshall and the early court upheld a federal institution that, which was much more controversial, I will assert, than the individual mandate, much more detrimental to individual liberty. I mean, the National Bank was throwing people in jail, Bank of the United States, throwing people in debtor's prison merely for owing debts long after any other institution in the U.S. was. And yet that was upheld as under the capacious, necessary, and proper power. Okay, we can come back and talk more about this doctrine and history a bit. Three concluding points, and here moving a bit away from the doctrine. The first is a historical point, and it goes to both the asserted novelty of this mandate to purchase in private markets and the correlate claim that this is somehow some novel intrusion on individual liberty. Although Congress has never used its commerce authority, its domestic commerce authority, in precisely this way, it has exercised other parts of the Constitution from the beginning to impose individual mandates to purchase. Perhaps most pertinently is one of the, is best I can tell, the first health law statute ever passed. In 1790, Congress exercised its Foreign Commerce Clause authority to mandate that all ship owners in foreign commerce purchase from an apothecary of known reputation a chest of medicines to be accompanied by directions of administering the same. In other words, go out in the private market, buy this, and then your sailors can use it, etc. Now, granted, these are people, these are business people, these are ship owners, not claiming any straight-line doctrinal moment, but it, what this does suggest is that mandates to purchase in the private market have been part of Congress's necessary and proper toolkit for quite some time, for over 200 years. Moreover, there are other examples too. One early militia statute said, you all have to come serve the country and bring a gun. Okay. Now again, the doctrinal answer is, I guess you could steal the rifle. It's not a mandate to purchase. But yeah, the real answer is, well, that's under the war powers, not the commerce clause, and or the militia clauses. And true, I mean, that's a doctrinal response. That's not necessarily a conceptual or philosophical response that this is somehow some new intrusion on liberty. Certainly, if we extend it further, government, and to include government, which would include the states, mandates are all over the place. You know, to be vaccinated, to send kids to school, if you ever drive at all, to purchase insurance in your car. Now, clearly, again, those are doctrinally distinguishable, but my suggestion here is that mandates are part of our constitutional tradition, and to make a slightly stronger claim, the mandate to purchase things in the private market can even be conceptualized as government treading somewhat more lightly on individual liberty than other alternatives which might be clearly constitutionally permissible but much more intrusive on liberty, like nationalizing hospitals and taxing everybody to pay for that. This is emphatically not what the ACA is doing. Okay, so consider, for instance, claims I'm sure Federalist Society debates in past years have considered privatizing Social Security. So what about if we put a mandate on people to save for retirement, but let them choose the investor? Okay, that's called privatizing Social Security. We have a mandate coupled with the right of choice in the private market. That actually is the ACA's scheme. You know, indeed, we jettison the public option. So what the mandate is telling people, you go buy it. You buy your health insurance from a group of choices. We have even much more broader choice and privatization in the actual delivery of medical care. When you actually go pick a doctor, and under most insurance plans, you have a choice of hundreds or thousands, or under Medicare, really any doctor licensed in the jurisdiction. So the broad point there is that I think the mandate is on doctrinally firm grounds, but I also think conceptually, in the broad traditions of American governance, it's not as dangerous or as novel as some have portrayed it. Now, that's only 7 points. The two points in 2 seconds. Well, again, this specific mandate also intrudes lightly on liberty. Can't be thrown in jail. IRS can't garnish your wages. They can't take your house. They can't take your car. Really, all they can do is if some future year, if you don't pay it, you get a big whopping refund, they can claw back what you owe. That's it. This is the intrusion of liberty, okay? And then finally, lastly, just the institutional point. And Professor Epstein mentioned the Republican debates. Republicans are going to muck things up for the Democrats. We've got an election coming up in November. This is an issue that is being hotly debated in the realm of popular politics. It is, in my view, not one of those issues that the court should wade into and foreclose that debate, which ought to continue in the November election and in Congress after that. And the court ought not, a bunch of unelected judges, wade in and foreclose that debate that's very robust in the public sphere right now. Thank you.
Well, let me make a few responses to what has been said, because I think that it was instructive that Ted wants to deny my major premise dealing with Wicked and Filburn. What I'd like to do now is to talk a couple of things that he did suggest. First of all, I want you to recall the level of equivocation that he had with respect to an evolving constitution. The defense that we have of Wicked and Filburn is that the Constitution can evolve. The attack that we make upon the challenges to the individual mandate is that you're trying to play games with the living Constitution. One of the reasons why I so dislike that term as a general matter is that constitutions seem to only evolve in ways that increase the level of power that the government has over you. My view is that we really do need a living constitution, and it's one that lives in the opposite direction and tries to move us headlong back into a regime where the level of government control over all public and private activities from the federal level is going to be smaller. So I'm left with the following puzzle as to why it is that this evolution should, and somehow or other, has become a one-way ratchet. The second point that I want to make is I quite agree with Ted that this is a last-minute piece of incredibly ingenious sort of manufacture of complicated complications in a debate which 2 years ago only talked about economic issues. The man most responsible for it is Randy Barnett, who was immensely persuasive and earnestly arguing this particular point. He's done two things, I think, that ought to be mentioned and added into this debate, which make the question not quite as quixotic as it sounds. The first of the points that you want to have about all of this is that if you're looking at the sort of individual mandate, what you have to do is to ask yourself, what's the limiting principle on the way in which this thing is going to be done? The way Ted puts it is that we can force you to do this because it's an integral part of a general health care scheme. Now the question under the Commerce Clause is, suppose we decide that all this financial fol-de-rol really doesn't work, and the next individual mandate is that everybody get up after 30 morning, report to their local fitness centers, and do calisthenics unless they get a government approval to dispense from it on the grounds that they have health care conditions that have been made worse by the Obamacare bill. You have to answer why it is this and why it is not that as you keep going on. You also have to say, if you can do this with respect to health care, why can't you do it with respect to anything else? And that itself also becomes, I think, a very difficult problem. The second point is that this is a different kind of situation from usual sorts of things that we've talked about where you put conditions on folks. To go back to the debate over the Medicaid mandate, which we didn't talk about here, it's in that area that you see Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who was very concerned about federalism having been a state legislator. Basically, in cases like New York against the United States, said that the real opposition that we had was not that there wasn't all sorts of interactions that took place between the federal and the state governments, but that you could isolate a certain subclass of events, which she called commandeering, which were the sort of things that state governments could not be told to do by the federal government. And if you try to figure out the commandeering doctrine, it's a little bit puzzling, because what they said is we can't force you to take title to nuclear waste, and that might cost you $1 million or $2 million. But on the other hand, we can impose these most incredible safety restrictions on this area, which would cost you billions upon billions of dollars. So whatever it is that leaves people uneasy about the commandeering stuff, taking away choice, forcing people into schemes, that's what drives the argument on behalf of the individual mandate. It is not some diffuse notion that everywhere and anywhere you go to the federal government that you have this kind of problem. And when you start thinking about it, I had a debate some time ago with Pamela Carlin, who is, I think, more passionate on her side than you are. I forgive you this. Actually, I praise you for it. And she says, well, we can always tie it to something. And so she says, anybody who wants to drive a car on a public road can now be required to take the mandate. Driving on a public road turns out to be an action. So what's the big trouble if we get rid of tying it to something we can do? And indeed, somebody else came up in the audience and said, well, we even have a better thing. If you want to breathe while you're in interstate commerce, you have to take out this healthcare situation. And the question is that a good or a bad argument? And that's actually a bad argument. Because what we do know with respect to the use of public highways is there is a set of doctrines under the heading of unconstitutional conditions, which limits the kind of conditions that the government can impose when it has a monopoly over a resource to which all members of the public have access. So it's perfectly okay to just give you the extreme cases, to say that if you get yourself involved in an accident, you have to subject yourself to the jurisdiction of a court that can adjudicate it. But it's not okay to say if you want to use the public highways, you have to surrender your Fourth Amendment rights to government people or decide not to participate in the next political election. So what happens, therefore, is when you start doing this as conditioning the stuff on various kinds of actions, what you discover is you run headlong into another doctrine, the unconstitutional conditions doctrine. Now, the other point that I want to make in finishing in the last minute is on the necessary and proper clause. And I want to divide it into two parts. First of all,
It is a perfectly dreadful decision in McCulloch v. Maryland on the facts, because when you tried to figure out what this bank was necessary and proper to, you found out it was like things like you can't have a mint without a bank. The difficulty is, of course, you can have a mint without a bank, and we've had one for hundreds of years. Every single analogy that was made by our Chief Justice Marshall to explain the power was, I think, demonstrably wrong. And that the words necessary and proper mean both necessary and proper. They don't mean some gushy, mushy form associated with the word appropriate. And the second point to make about it is, I think he recognized the sins of his ways. One of the things that's so characteristic about Gibbons and Ogden is that Justice Marshall consciously said that the interpretation of the Commerce Clause with respect to the scope of activities that could be undertaken was in no way altered by the Necessary and Proper Clause. What he said, in effect, is if you have the power over interstate commerce, it means that you can hire contracts to people to inspect goods that are on the middle of the roads or repair the highways or establish the post roads. But what you cannot do is sort of expand the ends. And so under those circumstances, everything that we have in Wicken and Filburn, which tries to rely on that, is doing exactly the wrong thing. It's extending the class of activities that are covered rather than regulating the transportation and the instrumentalities of interstate commerce. Thank you again.
A few points briefly. Most of your argument here is not, again, it differs from some of the other opponents in that you're not primarily making a slippery slope argument. Yours is more sophisticated than
thank
that.
You. Thank
but you. But you did raise the gym membership. I thank you for not raising the infamous broccoli hypothetical. And I don't know if you serve broccoli for lunch here, but I think this looms over every such debate. And it's the notion that, well, if the government can do this, can they pass a law making you eat your broccoli or go to the court to the gym? Few responses. First, of course, the apt conceptual analog, as most of you recognize, I assume, is a law requiring you to somehow subsidize broccoli, you know, or purchase shares in a broccoli enterprise. There's nothing, there's nothing in this individual mandate that forces anybody to access the healthcare system. Relatedly, there's nothing in this individual mandate that subverts basic state law constitutional principles, or arguably, I think more than arguably, the federal constitutional principle that people have a right to refuse medical care. Okay, so that's how I would. That's one answer to the kind of broccoli hypothetical, which applies in this way to the gym membership hypothetical. Requiring people to subsidize gyms because we think more gyms is a good idea is probably conceptually analogous to this individual mandate. Requiring people to go to the gym entails a degree of physical compulsion and intrusion that's not present in this statute. And again, it's more analogous to saying you must go to your doctor, and nothing in this statute says that. Here, I think there is, this is where it's unfortunate, and here I kind of blame the leaders, and the Democratic leaders in Congress and the administration. I think it's unfortunate that this wasn't characterized as a, you know, health insurance free rider tax. Just label it as such, describe it as such. I don't think we'd be having this debate today. I think looking at how the lower courts have responded to it, a big deal was they think and they're probably right, that the framers of this statute were trying to pull a fast one. Say, no new taxes, but get this mandate through. When in operation, it's a lot more like a tax. And what I mean by that is it imposes costs, monetary costs, not physical compulsion. There's no intrusion to the body in the way that vaccine mandates entail, in the way that broccoli eating mandates entail. That's one response to this slippery slope argument. Another is actually, of course, all of these arguments are federalism. This is a Commerce Clause debate. Okay, this is not an individual liberty debate. And we know that states vary in terms of how regulatory they are. If this is such a looming specter of overregulation, would we think that one of the 50 states might have imposed a gym attendance requirement or broccoli eating requirement? Of course, we don't see anything close to that. We do see, of course, an individual mandate in Massachusetts. But the point being, in our diverse political culture, including states that are a fair bit more regulatorily invasive than the Congress in terms of their kind of baseline median voter, we haven't seen anything like this parade of horribles. So I think that's point one. We would also, this goes to the point about this one-way ratchet away from individual liberty. I read the history differently, unsurprisingly. I read a steady diminution over the past 100 years of federalism restrictions on the federal government. I see a steady accretion of individual liberty restrictions on federal and state government regulation. So clearly this applies to people's bodies and the choices they make with them, which we have more liberty today than we did 100 years ago. It also applies to corporations' ability to advertise and speak and participate in political campaigns, whose liberty is dramatically greater over the past few decades than it was 100 years ago. It also, I would say, we have a greater degree of religious freedom than we did, restrictions on government action vis-a-vis religions, clearly for the minor religions, but even against something like the Catholic Church, which flexed its muscles in the past few weeks. Go back to the, Google Blaine Amendment, look at what was going on in the American states in the 1880s in terms of dramatic restrictions on Catholic schools and the Catholic Church, it makes this current kerfuffle of a few weeks ago seem very slight indeed. The debate has shifted, or the power has shifted. So this is a general constitutional point about liberty and the court and the government's role in protecting liberty that, yes, I think the federal government's regulatory power and its freedom from federalism restrictions has been expanded, but we or different courts and scholars and kind of the public at large has seemed to demand a increase in protections, both for individuals as well as for corporate forms like religious organizations and non-religious corporations. So that this is a mix that still is developing. Thank you.
We're nearly out of time. We will have two questions. Any students would like to ask a question?
We have one right over
here. One question.
Turn over here.
Here's one.
I'll ask. Professor Driven, you were speaking about the fact that people going into large firms or whatever, they're going to have insurance whether they want it or not anyway. My thought on that and my response to that is, in today's society, financially, the people that are most burdened, it seems, by the tax regimes and things like that are the middle class. And that this individual mandate is more militant against them than anybody else also. So how would you respond to that? How would it be different if it were, in fact, a tax as opposed to a mandate?
Oh, that's a very good question on multiple levels. First of all, the mandate's burdens would fall. So really what we're talking about is the mandate to purchase insurance or a penalty if you don't that interacts with a set of subsidy provisions in the middle. If we're talking about somebody, say, a single person making $40,000 a year or $50,000, too much to get Medicaid, you're going to get some subsidies when you purchase insurance, and then you also avoid the penalty. So, now here's a critique of the ACA, even as a supporter. And there's a woman in Minnesota, Amy Monahan, a tax law scholar, who has a nice paper on this. She makes a persuasive claim that the mix of subsidies and that the incentive structure is all wrong, and it hits people at $40,000 or $50,000. She claims that Massachusetts got it right, in that at almost any income level, from say $30,000 up to $70,000. In Massachusetts, the subsidies kind of are generous enough that they help you, kind of participate in this. So that's one point. Now, this refers back to Professor Epstein's, one of his first points. And this, look, again, most supporters of the mandate don't focus on it, but it has a tax rate. It's not merely an anti-free rider measure. It indeed is a tax on the young and the healthy. It's an actuarial tax on the young and the healthy, because you have to buy. People have to buy insurance based, and if you're young and healthy, you're going to pay more than the actuarial underwriting rate because of restrictions elsewhere in the Act on accurate pricing on insurance for people with pre-existing conditions or older people or women of childbearing age, it turns out. So it basically regulates insurance actuaries from pricing you exactly at your risk, which is a tax on youth and on health. Now, here's a liberal critique of that. Allison Hoffman of UCLA has made this persuasively. That starts to look a little bit like a regressive tax, because you're taxing people in the middle brackets. It might be fairer to use progressive income taxation to do that.
No, you don't want to do that.
I know you don't. It would be fairer.
Well, fairness is in the eyes of the beholder. Somehow or other, every tax that's never progressive enough. Let me make two comments on that. First of all, I didn't have a chance to respond to this earlier, but I think that there are two responses to what Ted said. One is, it is an enormous difference when a government or when an employer decides to impose something upon you. If it's an employer in a competitive market, they're going to impose it upon you knowing that you go elsewhere if it turns out that you don't like it. And what they're doing in many cases is trying to make a judgment as to how it is you maximize joint surplus between the parties. And generally speaking, employment relationships cannot survive with cross-subsidies, because the moment one tries to do it with respect to one group of workers, what happens is all the people who are giving the subsidy will move somewhere else. So the way in which a government does this is by mandate and tax. I'll talk about it in a second. What an employer does is says, here is a package of $15,000 in benefits that you get. You allocate it between health insurance, life insurance, vacation pay, and so forth. We're indifferent. You pick the thing that maximizes your stuff. It's a completely different policy. One of them is wealth enhancing. The other is going to be pathological in its long-term implications. The second point is, I didn't stress this before, but it is not just a matter of words as to whether this is a tax or whether it's a penalty. If you're going to do this thing as a tax, there is no way that you could pass a tax which says, what we're going to do is impose a tax on all individuals under such and such an age for such and such an amount. What you have to do is to fund it out of general revenues, which means that the burden of the tax is going to fall on different people. So the great principle of Leo DeRocher, let's you and him fund, is essentially what's at stake here. Because what they were able to do in this bill is to get those people who are going to be recipients on this to put the cost on somebody else. They could not have gotten this thing through, in my judgment, if they were prepared to fund it in the way that taxes are generally funded out of general revenues. So it's not just a talking point or a strategy. One of the reasons why you want general taxes is, in effect, to reduce the level of factionism and discord that takes place inside a society. And by putting this thing as a penalty, not only do you change the political procedures, which committees you go through, you fundamentally change it. So my view about it is that if you say that you want to get this through as a tax, even labeling it as such, you don't come within the parameters of the spending clause, even it's modernly construed, which again is a complete intellectual hazard. It says tax and spend for the general welfare of the United States. They did not mean individual citizens. They meant the nation as an entity trying to deal with itself in international law. But this is part of the balderization of the American Constitution that we have placed there. So I think, in effect, that when you look at this stuff, the political process points really ought to count very heavily. And you should strike the tax down to the extent that it's a tax which doesn't meet the normal requirements of a decent one.
I'm going to call this meeting to close.
What? It's early.
Before you yell that, I can call you my lawyer. We can go to, two.
I don't think anyone's driving us out of the room.
Is there one more question?
Yeah. Come on. What a bunch of... Come on. That's good. Hold up the honor of the Penn Law School.
Okay. Regardless of your personal opinions on the constitutionality, how do you believe the court, with regard to either personal views or their eye on the political arena, either not wanting to interfere or trying to be Anthony Kennedy and get in the middle of things, how do you think they're going to end up on this?
Did you write a brief in this or not?
I wrote two. Yeah, you wrote three, right?
I wrote three. painful experience. Well, should we declare ourselves?
I'll go first. So my prediction, I have very low confidence. One of my early works as a scholar was demonstrating how poor law professors are at predicting cases. I predict that this will be up. The mandate will be upheld by a 6-3 vote, which includes Roberts and Kennedy, along with the four more predictable votes. But that's.
So you're basically drawing an Alito-Roberts split.
Yeah, which may be unfounded.
No, I mean, let me put it to this way: as a betting person, somebody who's attacking the mandate is trying to fill an inside strip. They've got four cards, and they have to get one. And if you go back and look at all the earlier cases, people like Kennedy and then O'Connor were always wobbly on the Commerce Court. This goes a little bit before what they've done. So I think that the real question here will depend upon the extent to which the mood music associated with the recent federalism cases, which treat this, in the words of Kennedy, as a great repository of individual liberty, which came up this term in a case called Bond, which has nothing whatsoever to do with anything we're talking about here. If they resonate to that, you could see it going 5-4. The other four are like the Rock of Gibraltar. Nothing we say or do could have the slightest influence on them. But that becomes a thing. I think it's still less than 50-50. But remember, we started from 0-100 is the odds when we had this debate the first time. And now, in effect, is actually you probably get enough action on both sides of the market that you can make a living as a bookie on this particular on the mandate of the Medicare stuff, I think it's no state has upheld the challenge to the mandate. No court has upheld it. I actually regard it in many